You're listening to the music of the Dogon people. And for me, it's pretty hard to listen to. But the point of playing music from this small ancient tribe in West Africa is because, maybe as many of you know, the Dogon pose an interesting dilemma for those of us who want to move from our knowns, our comfortable, sciency, archaeological, history is what they teach us in school kind of reality, to the extended reality that we explore so much on this show. And that is because the Dogon, like many ancient people, have always claimed that their ancestors came from the stars. It's an ancient alien kind of thing. But what's unique about the Dogon and the way they relate to today's guest is that when the Dogon first encountered Western anthropologists in the 1830s, they told them some specific information that they were given by their star brother ancestors. In particular, they told anthropologists that they were from the Sirian star system, a star which is one of the brightest stars in the sky. So bright, in fact, they said, that it obscured the fact that there was a smaller dwarf star circling around the visible star. But in the 1830s, this was impossible to see, even with the telescopes of the time. In fact, it wasn't visible until the telescope technology that we had in 1970, when astronomers looked and were able to confirm that there is a twin star around Sirius. But the Dogon had more to say, much more. They correctly said that the orbital spin of the dwarf star was something like 50 years, and that there were three planets that would show up, and they had specific information about the density of these planets and their rotation, other information that would be impossible, it would seem, for an ancient culture without even a written language to know about. But again, the question for me is, how do we go from the known to the unknown? You write, Tibetan lamas voluntarily lock themselves into lightless underground cells for up to 3 years. This is what you've discovered from a guy who's been there, been to India, have met with these people, have enough of a credibility in terms of what you've done and your own spiritual journey to talk to these people on this level and to learn this stuff. Returning to your email, this would drive the average person insane. But the purpose of the incarceration is, among other things, to develop the ability to soul travel.
Like the spider who creates his own web, we have this ability to, because consciousness has this great range of flexibility, we can create through our intention, that's the key, intentionality, a bubble, an ectoplasmic bubble, if you will, and we just travel in that, powered by thought and intention.
Stick around. My interview with Steve Briggs is up next on Skeptico. Today we welcome Steve Briggs to Skeptico. Steve is the author of India, Mirror of Truth, a book that chronicles his amazing journey and experiences with a variety of Indian mystics, yogis, and otherwise just amazing people. It's quite an incredible account, and I'm super excited to have Steve join me today on Skeptico. Steve, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Well, thanks, Alex. It's a pleasure to be talking to you, especially when you're in California and I'm out here in the cold in the middle of Iowa, and it's going to be below zero for the rest of the year. So get a little sunshine from you.
Well, yeah, I'll try and send it your way. So, Steve, we met through your longtime friend and a guy I consider my friend, Rick Archer, who hosts a very excellent podcast that I reference frequently on this show called Buddha at the Gas Pump. And since your relationship with Rick really leads right into your book, I thought we might kind of start there with your background, how you know Rick, and then the story of how you came to write this book.
Rick and I were on a meditation retreat, I think it was in 1974, so that dates us way back. I was in the French Alps, and actually Rick was leading the retreat. There were a couple hundred of us, mostly were Americans, and So we got to know each other there. We met, and then both of us later on got married, and our wives had been friends since they were teenagers. So we have a long connection. He's a great guy. And a further thing was that for about 10 years, we were also on a what's called a Brahmachari program, a single man kind of monkish program together. And we traveled to Philippines and India and Germany and Switzerland over those. So I got to know Rick really well.
And this is all in the service devotion to Maharishi.
This was in the context of Maharishi Mahesh Yogi's Transcendental Meditation program. And I would say more in the direction of some of his advanced programs, which a lot of times aren't as well known. But we did projects for him. I did projects for Maharishi in India for those 7 years, which was the genesis of the book I wrote. And we spent 6 months in the Philippines with President Marcos and all kinds of fun stuff, interesting, different kind of lifestyle that we had there. I was on that program for, I think, 22 years.
So, you know, you're talking about it in a rather nonchalant way, which is fine, but yeah. This is completely outside of, one, your background. You're an MBA.
Yeah.
It's outside, especially at that time, although there was this kind of spiritual uprising in the U.S., especially as it related to India, and that was all mainly driven by Maharishi. So, I mean, take us back to that time and what that whole experience was for you at the time. And then, again, you just touched on how that led to you writing this book. Take us through that.
Well, Alex, I got into meditation to become a better tennis player. This is when I was 19, just a freshman in college, University of Arizona, on a tennis scholarship. And tennis meant the world to me then. It's still my occupation. I teach tennis. But what I found when I immediately started to meditate was that my game got better. I felt better about myself. I felt more confident. I felt more coordinated physically, mentally. And that led me to really want to dig deeper. Yeah, we were just coming out of the late 60s. For me, that was learning TM was, I think, in 1972. And so there's a big transition going on in America, and everybody was trying to wake up to new principles and new cultural values. And so I learned TM, and within 9 months, I ran off to Switzerland to become a quote, teacher of meditation with Maharishi up in the Alps. He came several times, spent some time with us. And then things developed a few years later. He was looking for a couple people to go to India and teach some courses to the corporate people. I think it was in 1981 or 82, India began to shift from a socialist orientation culturally and economically. They wanted to open their markets. And Maharishi wanted to just jump right in there and get some creativity, get some energy, get some leadership for that move. He thought it was a good thing. So he sent us over, and we started teaching corporate meditation courses to all kinds of Indian leaders, really interesting people, really the forefathers of what we see as far as the economic growth in the country today. So we were over there teaching all over the country, every big city, everywhere on the coast, down in Tamil Nadu, we were up in the Himalayas, we were everywhere teaching. But whenever we didn't have a course, very often we'd run off to see the saints. We'd run off and we'd go, especially in the summertime when it was hot, we'd go up in the mountains, we'd go up in the Himalayas, and we'd spend 2-3 weeks at the source of the Ganges. We would go to all the holy pilgrimage spots. And, you know, naturally along the way, you'd meet some pretty unusual people. So that was sort of how it all started. And it we had no idea when we jumped on board to go to India that we were going to be there for 7 years. But it was absolutely the best time of my life. And the reason I wrote the book, Alex, is because when I got back from India, I missed it so much. I got back. I had to leave India. I got very, very sick after 7 years. If people who've been to India know, it's a little bit hard on your body. And I got quite sick. And one physician said, don't go back for 2 years. You can't risk that. So I didn't. But at the same time, I was missing it. So I started writing about it. And the book you mentioned is what came out of that.
The book, and you've written two books, and we probably won't have a chance to talk much about the other one, but what is the name of the other book?
The other one's called The Tale of the Himalayan Yogis, and that's a novel. It's also, the Himalayas for me was such a transformative experience, not just visually, but everywhere I went, the holy rivers up there and the incredible people I met, and not just saintly people, but the villagers and the people who just live there and farm there and have been there for generations. It's just an incredibly, you don't feel like you're on planet Earth, to be honest.
So, yeah, I definitely get that sense. And a lot of people get that sense in talking to people like you or meeting, some of these mystics that come over to the United States, some of these yogis. And I guess that's why I wanted to kind of have you on, because not so much to talk really directly about the book, although as much as I've read of the book, I can say it's excellent, really well written. I can't believe
you
wrote such a book. And then you've written a fiction book on top of that. Quite an accomplishment. But what I really wanted to talk about and what I wanted to just kind of invite you into this conversation is to get some of that experience that you have and relate it to some of the things that I've been poking into. So I got interested in looking at this extended consciousness stuff through Skeptico. And I wanted to stay really close to the science. So I started with parapsychology because that's really safe and it's sciency. And then I got into looking at peer-reviewed near-death experience science. Because again, it was in this extended consciousness realm, but I could still talk about it from a very sciencey kind of perspective and all the rest of it. But in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, I'm a yogi. I mean, I'm a long time. Anyone's a yogi who says they're a yogi. And I've practiced yoga for 30 years. I've always been a student of yoga. I've been a meditator. So whatever someone wants to advance as their credentials, I don't have a lot of credentials, but I still consider that perspective as being central to who I am. So I always felt like there were these two kind of things going on. I wanted to explore the science side, but I always had in the back of my mind that there are these people out there that just blow all this stuff away in a way that we can't really explain. And when we do try and explain, it comes out as either fake, like someone's just making it up, or it comes out as so fantastic that people can't really grab it. So here was kind of the breaking point that really led me to you. I've gotten interested, and I always have been, but I've re-upped my interest in the ET stuff. And primarily because a buddy of mine, Ray Hernandez, who's been working for a long time in setting up this organization with former astronaut Dr. Edgar Mitchell, and who also founded IONS. And these guys decided a few years ago that the UFO research thing was really headed in the wrong direction, and what they needed to do was focus on experiencers, people who've had contact with ET. And even though that sounds very strange to people, they decided that they were going to approach it in a very scientific way, as scientific as they could, with a very well-designed scientific survey to try and understand these experiences. And the net result of that, Steve, is this movement among that community to kind of recast these contact experiences as spiritually transformative experiences, because that's kind of where they go. They line up with the near-death experiences. And that's the point where I jumped ship and said, wait a minute, what are we looking at here when we're starting to call these experiences genuine spiritual experiences? Are these somehow counterfeited spiritual experiences? And then that caused me to re-examine whether any spiritual experience is genuine or whether we're counterfeiting all of them. And that's the time that I very fortunately ran into the excellent interview you did with Rick on Bat Gap. And I said, this guy is perfect to really add some meat and substance to these folks out there, these Indian yogis and mystics who, and adepts who just have maybe found a way to manipulate this extended consciousness in a way that will inform some of these issues. So I've talked for a super long time, but I did want to set that up as a background. And then where I wanted to kind of lead you is all the way back to your story and talk about tennis.
Okay.
Because in your interview with Rick, you guys opened it up in really kind of a cool way in talking about tennis. And you, Steve, related it back to even an earlier experience you had as a kid. That you want to talk about that experience and that first extraordinary kind of extended consciousness experience?
Be happy to. It's my pet theory that anyone who dedicates themselves to or is passionate about something, whether it's dance or art or astronomy or tennis, soccer, that if they, or chanting the Vedas, if you focus yourself and are dedicated to it, you develop your consciousness. You're developing yourself. And as I got started with tennis when I was, I think 6 years old, my brother was 8. Our father had been a state champion. So as soon as we were old enough, the rackets came from the department store. And by the first day, we went out and played two girls who were 3 years older than us. We didn't get a game. I was 6 years old, and we didn't know that they were the city champs. But they, I thought, I don't care. I'm going to beat those girls, in a short period of time. And so we really, took to it. And I had a brother who was equally interested, and we just played and played and played all summer, every day. Like within a couple of years, we were playing national tournaments. Now, we had the help of a father who knew how to play. There were no coaches. There weren't even indoor courts in our town in the Midwest, in Illinois, Rock Island. But as time went by, we developed. We were pretty good athletes. And by the time I was 15, I was playing on the center court in the United States, the USTA National Junior Championships. I was playing he was 10th or 12th ranked player in the country from Southern California. And the match was nip and tuck. We could have gone either way. And I was struggling in the match because there were these red, white, and blue banners. It was the national championship. So they had these banners behind the court. Tennis balls back then were white, and I couldn't see the ball very well with the white part of the background. So I was trying to figure out there's got to be some way that I can pick up his serve better so that I can, play a better match. And as I focused deeper and deeper and got more resolve that I got to figure this out because we're down to crunch time, suddenly and gradually a shift started to occur. And there was a lot of different ways that I could describe that shift. And one was everything slowed down. It seemed like my decision making I had a lot more time to decide what I wanted to do with the ball. His shot seemed to slow down. The ball was bigger, and sometimes the tennis players on the pro tour, they describe the tennis ball as big as a cantaloupe. It's just that, and it's the same ball. There's nothing different, Alex, in the same dimensions in the court, in the same racket. Maybe the sun's brighter, maybe the wind's blowing, but all the specifics are the same. But suddenly there was a shift very clear inside of me, and that shift translated into a better play. And back then we talked about as being in the zone. And sometimes we tease each other. You're playing up in the trees. That was a 70s term. You're up in the trees here, like an ape or something. And so that wasn't just me feeling happy inside that this is cool and I'm witnessing or I'm not involved and I'm playing, but I actually won the match because of it. So there was a concrete, practical result to this shift, at least from my point of view. And as time went by, people in athletics and in other areas, ballet, whatever you want to look at, soccer, they began to talk about these fields of consciousness and how they impact sports performance or any performance. If you're not thinking clearly, you're not going to be a very good physicist that day. If you've had a good meditation or you've had a good night's sleep or whatever, you may have some insights. You may, do something brilliant.
The one I threw out to you in the email exchange, and this always interests me on a couple of different levels, but in baseball, if you really do the math on 100 mile an hour fastball, there is no way that anyone should ever hit that. And they kind of fudge the numbers and make it kind of, well, if you could, in 2 milliseconds, of it, you know, it doesn't make any sense because you were relating it to a lot of different things. The net-net for me is that reality is a lot more flexible than we think. And you found a way, and you found multiple ways, one in tennis, and then that's probably what opened you up to a more of an interest in meditation.
It did.
Understanding the flexibility of reality. And I relate it back to, you know, I was talking about parapsychology. One of the first guys I talked to and things I got interested in was Dean Radin at IONS, who's done this in Dr. Dean Radin, incredible, peer-reviewed multiple times, multiple labs, over and over again, this presentiment effect where people are shown this image and they have the natural ability to know, their body knows and responds before the image is shown, whether it's going to be some kind of graphic, violent image or just some pastoral, kind of nice, calm thing. And I said, you know, isn't that like in the lab a demonstration of the flexibility of reality? And then there you are experiencing it on the tennis court, and then you're relating it to people who have downloads and all this other stuff. But what if we take a step back? I just would love you for you to comment on this idea. If we fully embrace the idea that reality is flexible in all these different ways, that's kind of uncomfortable too. I mean, what does that mean?
I love that term. Reality is flexible. I believe it's infinitely flexible. It has no limit to its pliability. And I hope we can, you know, delve into that a little bit more later on. But one example of that flexibility is I had, I don't know if you want to call it precognitive, but I knew what my opponent in this match that I was referencing, I knew what my opponent was going to, where he was going to hit his serve. Once my awareness had shifted into this, what I would call it, a more quantum mechanical state, a more holistic state of awareness, a less tense state of mind, just more fluid, then suddenly great things were happening. And it was like, hey, it's like I'm a man playing against a child. I had this advanced inside information. And, you know, it's like being an insider on Wall Street. How can you lose? You know, so I don't care for the analogy. But anyway, that's how it felt. And that's what the result was. And I, you know, I won that match and went on to, you know, get a top 15 ranking in the country based on 1 hour of transcendent experience.
And then you use that. I love how the story goes. The coach is getting mad because you were teaching everyone TM. Everyone was meditating, and it was effective in your success on the court.
We had all my old college buddies. We had a varsity of 8 players, and 5 out of the 8 guys learned to meditate the year that I became a teacher. My brother was there, including my brother, my doubles partner, and we went on to win 3 conference championships and 3 top 10 NCAA finishes, and we were having a blast. You know, we were all free. We had a couple of guys, Southern California surfer bums, that they've took to it really easily. And so the only downside was our coach kept saying, hey, how come you guys never come down and have coffee with me at the hotel for breakfast? Because we were all up in our rooms dutifully doing 20 minutes of meditation, you know, before we showed up. So
let's skip ahead in the story, and now it's natural that you would be drawn to Maharishi, and the TM stuff works for you. And then, as you said, he's an interesting figure, and we're going to pull that apart a little bit, because one of the things I love about Rick and about you and listening to you is, you know, there's some shadiness to Maharishi. There always has been. And I'm always leery of people who won't own that. And both of you guys have found a way to own that, take the good, leave the bad, try and understand it at a deeper level without running from it or just pretending like it didn't exist. And those are always litmus tests for me, because when people can't own that, then it's like there's another part of the shadow that we can't penetrate. Do you want to address that in a general
sense? I'd be happy to talk about it. Sure. You know, I think I have maybe potential for a little bit of a decent, reasonable insight, because the 7 years I was in India and then the 40 plus years that I've been interacting with guru figures and so forth. So If we look at it a little bit from the Indian culture point of view, just as a general picture, and then we can hone in on specific stuff. My experience in today's Indian culture and Hindu culture, Vedic culture, it has a male bias. Boys are raised in the sense that they can't really do anything wrong. They're princes. And that has its positive stuff. They grow up with confidence and they believe that they can do all the things that their parents give them the sense that they can do. Girls, on the other hand, are kept in the house and domesticated more. And I think that that paradigm is changing. I don't want to kind of stereotype it too severely, but I think a lot of the guru figures that we've grown up with in the past 50 years come out of that cultural background, that paradigm. So if you look at gurus in India, a lot of times they're called God men. And that's an amazingly broad term to apply to any human being. So we get that little bit of background that maybe they are, as human beings, a lot of the guru figures are possibly puffed up a little bit more than they really should be. And whether a particular guru or not is in the highest state of enlightenment, I certainly am not qualified to comment. I can only judge their actions, my interactions with them, the work they do, the clarity of their mind as they speak, and so forth. And what I found is that, yes, I really have felt like I learned to take the good and discard what I didn't find to be so good.
Yeah, but hold on, because let me, we're kind of dancing around things here.
So okay.
So let's make sure, first of all, that people know what we're talking about. First of all, the Beatles show up and they're at Maharishi's feet and they think everything's great. And then the next thing you know, John Lennon says, "Get away from me, you creep. You just made a pass at me, a pharaoh, and you're just a creep," you know. And then everyone goes, "Oh, no, that couldn't have happened." And, you know, we even have Deepak Chopra, you know, saying, "Oh, well, you know, I talked to him later and it didn't happen." Well, Deepak is here in San Diego, and I know a lot of people know him personally, and he's no one to be. He's not someone I would trust on sexual indiscretions that need to be hidden. But the point being, Steve, without bearing the lead, because what I think really throws people for a loop is we're trying to understand this extended consciousness realm. And beyond that, we're trying to understand this spiritual realm. And we hold these people up as not just like, you know, you're saying of a really advanced godlike boy. We're saying they're closer connected to God than we are. So when they fall, it makes us question, the fundamental question is, what is their relationship to God, to the larger spiritual truths that they espouse? How could they stumble? And if they can stumble, what hope is there for us?
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I think one of the devastating experiences that a devotee or someone on the path who has a guru is that if they find that the guru is something less than they thought when they first got on board, it could throw them right off their spiritual path. It could really lead to cynicism and doubt and all kinds of things that would not probably be helpful to their long-term evolution, their own growth. I think one of the problems is that we place these individuals on too high of a pedestal. They are human beings. And I'm going to address exactly what you were asking. Maharishi had been accused back in the day. That article even came out in the Daily Beast. I don't know if you saw it, a big, big article that came out. Maharishi's been passed away for over 10 years. And again, it referenced Mia Farrow. At one point in time, after I'd written the book that you mentioned, a lady came to me and she, you know, I thought she wanted me to become her new mentor. She was a devotee of Maharishi's. And she came to our house. My wife and I had a house in Fairfield. She came to our house and she started talking. She said, "You know, Maharishi made these overtures to me way, way back." And, you know, that was the first I'd heard of anything. And it was a shock to my system because, you know, when I was 24 years old, Maharishi had suggested that Rick Archer and myself and others that we adopt a celibate lifestyle. And we stuck to that. I was in that program for, I think, 20 plus years. And, you know, Maharishi in our minds was always defined as a monk, as a life celibate. And so then this lady comes to my house and says, no, that's not true. And it was, you know, I had to suddenly do some soul searching, thinking, what does this mean to me? Because I've spent, you know, a couple of decades following the advice of a guru who I venerated, and I still, in spite of some of these things that we're discussing now, I have an enormous regard and respect for Maharshi. So I dealt with it, I digested it, but I don't view Maharshi as someone who never made a mistake, either personally or professionally. I don't put him on that level because I don't think it's fair to him. And I also don't think it's fair to a disciple to have someone say, do as I say, but not as I do.
Sure.
And I also don't feel comfortable when an organization goes into a mode of denial or cover-up. And I don't think that that has happened in the TM organization, but
Well, it kind of has, but...
I haven't seen people respond to that question other than, you know, of course, Deepak's comments like that. But I know it's there, and I know that if you were to go one by one through all the different gurus that have come from India, I'm referring more to the male gurus right now, I think there would be a very small list out of about 20 that maybe had lived up to their billing as a swami or a monk. I think that we'd probably find that we'd be disappointed.
And I guess where I really wanted to go with that, Steve, is kind of, again, I call it these level three discussions. Like, I get that, and everyone gets caught up on both sides of that. One, did he or didn't he? And then second, what does that mean that he did? Oh, he's a despicable person. I'm interested in level three, which is, what does that say? What does that tell you about the ultimate nature of spirituality? Because, Steve, first of all, we got to let people into your world in that you saw this guy, this man, do amazing things, both to you with a look, with a touch, with a voice, amazing things. And not just your experience where you're kind of hallucinating or making it up in your mind, hundreds or thousands of other people as well. So there was some power, there's some force there. And then we have to relate that back to, you know, the individual. And then add to that, you have all these other experiences with other amazing people that further confirm that it wasn't just this guy, but there is this.
Yeah.
So let's dive into that. What does this tell us about the nature of spirituality?
Well, I think part of it is how we define enlightenment. Most people say, my guru is in the highest state of enlightenment. And again, as at the very beginning, I said, I could never be qualified to say that other than my personal intuitions from interacting with presumably several enlightened masters. But I don't define enlightenment as a person who is a perfect human being. That's a definition that I don't subscribe to. And that's really softened my ability to handle some of these bits of information that come my way. I think that perfection comes later in the game, and we can talk about that or not, but I do believe that the gurus and masters and fully enlightened masters can and do from time to time make mistakes, and maybe big mistakes. So in the end, it's my personal philosophy that I have to look to my own inner guide first and foremost. And to whatever extent someone from the outside, whether it's Rick or you or a friend or my wife or a mentor or a guru, whatever they recommend to me, if it makes sense, then I adopt it. But my inner gyroscope, my inner measure of things still becomes my primary guru.
I got that. Let me approach this from another angle, because in the email you wrote to me, which maybe will jump us into these amazing experiences that you have, because I feel like we're still nibbling on the outside. You write, Tibetan lamas voluntarily lock themselves into lightless underground cells for up to 3 years. This is what you've discovered from a guy who's been there, been to India, have met with these people, have enough of a credibility in terms of what you've done and your own spiritual journey to talk to these people on this level and to learn this stuff. Returning to your email, this would drive the average person insane. But the purpose of the incarceration is, among other things, to develop the ability to soul travel. Once the Lama learns to leave the body at will, he can travel throughout the cosmos. His physical incarnation is no longer a limitation. I have been taught these methods and used them. And we'll leave it right there as a bit of a cliffhanger to talk about later. But do you see where I'm going now? Here is a technique that whether you're a scoundrel, well, we don't know because there's the yamas and the niyamas, but it isn't saying you have to meet these other moral criteria. It says, hey, if you do some kind of sensory deprivation thing, if you do some kind of breathing thing, some kind of meditation, tennis related kind of thing, you can leave your body and travel. And so let's talk about what that means in terms of, we said that reality is maybe more flexible than we think.
Absolutely.
The next step would be saying maybe these extended consciousness realms are more flexible than we think. And then the third part is there a spiritual reality that stands apart from that, or is it all just extended consciousness?
Well, one of the beautiful things that Maharishi taught me, I remember way, way back, he said, now I'm giving you this technique that can take you all the way to the goal, which what he described as cosmic consciousness, enlightenment. He said, but capture the fort. Don't go after the gold mines. If you capture the fort, enlightenment, everything in the perimeter around you will be yours automatically. All the gold mines, silver mines, diamond mines, they're all yours. And he was referencing that a diamond mine is, say, the ability to teleport. A gold mine might be the ability to bilocate. All these supernormal powers that, you know, sometimes we see in the superhero movies in the theater. So we have that as a baseline. And when I got to the Himalayas, I'll just tell you one little story. I met this fellow named Maharaj. And Maharaj had been living up there for decades, summer and winter. And he didn't speak any English, but I was talking to him through his disciple who was translating because he had perfect English. And I wanted to get an idea where Maharaj's consciousness was at. So I said, Maharaj, if you don't mind, what do you do at night when you're asleep? And I had a reason for that, because I was aware that yogi sleep might be different than your sleep or my sleep, where we're just sawing wood. So he looked up to the sky. It was, in the morning. He looked up to the sky and pointed, and he said, through translator, he said, at night, during my yogic sleep, I go to that planet, and I go to Jupiter, I go to Mars, I go to the moon, I travel. And that made perfect sense to me, because I had had some of those kind of experiences myself, and that, to me, was an innocent confirmation. Now, he may have been just putting me on. Who knows? He may have been counterfeit, but I didn't have any... there was no agenda. I wasn't going to give him $100 for talking to me. We were just talking as two people. Actually, we were pretty much strangers at that point. So that was my first conversation with somebody who had, quote, gone out of the body. Now, since that time, that's 20 years ago, I've had a lot of experience that we could qualify as out of the body. And some people have written about those experiences as a result of near death. Accidents, automobile accident, illness. There's been bestsellers written by people who have thought they died and come back. As I began to meet Tibetans, some of the lamas up there, this is an area called Ladakh. It's actually 100. It's a pure Tibetan culture than Tibet, because what the Chinese have done to Tibet, but they haven't been able to get into Ladakh because it's within the Indian borders. So it's been saved, preserved in its integrity. So we spent some time at some of the monasteries up there, and you mentioned that there are these underground cells where they don't only lock you in there, they have a little hole where you can get one meal a day, but they cement you in. Now, no one's forced to do that, but you go in there if you want to, if you feel like you're ready for it, and you go in there and you stay in a lightless cubicle for 3 years. You start out doing it 3 days, then you do 3 weeks, then you do 3 months, and then if all that goes according to your satisfaction as the Lama, you may commit to 3 years. Now, there's nothing to do in an 8x8 cubicle with no light and one meal a day, right? So you're going to go stark raving mad if you're just sitting in there. Maybe even if you're a good meditator, you're going to really face your demons. But as I was told, these guys do this because it helps. They're given a technique and taught how to do it. They learn to use their, quote, light body, and they travel, and they might be having a better time in that cell than we are traveling the world in airplanes, because they move through the universe this is using their terms, as easily as we move around in a car, easier, or in an airplane. And if they didn't have that ability, I think they probably, most of them, would be completely bonkers within a week. So it sort of pushes the issue that this idea of flexibility of reality, flexibility of consciousness, they are sort of forced to make that leap of disconnecting the binding influence between the soul and the body. Now, when they travel, and when I've traveled, these were not techniques, I want to make clear, that I learned from Maharshi. I learned them from a saint in the Himalayas named Keshava, and maybe we'll get around to that. He's written about in the story.
This is great. Steve, I love the way you kind of tiptoe into this stuff, because you're a deep guy. You have some amazing stories and experiences that you could tell, and you just kind of talked about traveling. So tell us how you learned to travel.
So about the third or fourth year into being in India, I was up there at a place called Joshi Math. This is one of the holy pilgrimage areas of the Himalaya, high Himalayas. It's deep in, takes about 8 hours to get there from Rishikesh, which is 4 hours beyond Delhi. So it's about a 12-hour drive from the capital of Delhi. And I was up on a meadow when I met a very handsome, beautiful, I mean, he looked to be about 25 years old, Indian yogi who sat down with me, and we talked, and he asked me questions, and I asked him questions, and the more I talked to him, the more I was spellbound by his wisdom and by his insight and how well he seemed to know me. He had kind of the prototype, typical, you know, look of, you know, he had white robes, and he had longish shoulder length hair, and he didn't have an ounce of gray in him, and he probably could have been any age as far as his wisdom. And he started to instruct me. He said, "Now, you're aging." I asked him, I said, "How come you're not aging and I'm aging?" Because he kind of tipped his situation, said he was very, very old, much, much older than 25 years old, maybe hundreds of years old. And I said, "Well, I've already got gray hair and I'm 50 years old. So what's going on here?" He said, "Oh, no, don't worry about that. It's just the result of a few lingering negative thoughts that you've had in your life." And I go, "Oh, well, if aging is a result of negative thoughts, I'm in, you know, big trouble, because I'm no saint." So we talked about that, and he said, "Listen, here's some things I would like you to consider doing." And he didn't sit down and initiate me formally, but he said, "I really think you would enjoy doing this, what he called circular breathing. It's just this, and you can do," he said, "do it all day." He said, "Do it when you're on the telephone, riding in a car, sitting on a plane, but conscious breathing." He said, "The body can survive with just breathing unconsciously, but when you add consciousness to your breathing, you are moving very rapidly then in the direction of God. Because your greatest connection to God is your breath." And I thought, wow, this is very, very profound. And I adopted it. I started doing it. I do it in between points even to this day on a tennis court. So that was one thing he suggested. Another thing he suggested, and I don't know if we should put a caveat, I say don't do this at home, but he said, "Listen, get your mantra going and keep it going 24/7. Now, 24/7 means literally that, whether you're awake, asleep, or dreaming. And that takes some skill. That's yogic to me. That's truly an advanced thing, because to set up, you might want to call it autopilot, but if you can set up a condition of your mind so that as you're going through your life, you have that resonating in the background, that's fairly, to my mind, a fairly advanced ability. So those are a couple of things that he suggested I do. And a third thing that Keshava suggested to do was, he asked me, "Who do I love in terms of divine? Who do I love? Do you love Jesus?" I said, "Well, I was born a Christian, but I relate more to the Vedic, to Hindu tradition." Now he said, "Okay, choose someone, Krishna, Ram, Buddha. Who do you like?" I said, "Krishna's good. Krishna's good." And so he said, "Okay, breathe him through your chest, breathe him into your heart, merge with him. Whether you have a picture, an image of him in your mind or your heart, but breathe that divine presence into you and do it whenever you like. And don't feel like you got to do it every day. So you've been so good at meditating. Marcy said, don't miss meditation, do it twice a day. And you've done that now for over, at the time, it was 30 years. So those were three things that he taught me to do. And as we got more advanced, he gave me some other instructions on how to lift out of my physical 6'3", 190-pound body and go up into what we discovered was a temple on a level which would be out of the body. Would be not. There's no physical temple equivalent here on Earth, but I would go up there.
Now, let me interject something here, Steve. So how do you process this? Because I'm listening to this, as most people are, and they're going, okay, gotcha. Breathe. Good. I got it. Love, mantra, got it. Jesus, Krishna, got it.
Go to a temple in the sky, don't got it.
Yeah. How did you experience that? The people who are listening to this show know there are plenty of people out there who have done astral travel in one way or another and have even come close to verifying it, although some people wouldn't agree with the verification. It's on the table.
Okay, first I backtrack for a moment. Marshy used to tell us, we don't astral travel. He said, don't astral travel. He said, maybe it was at that point in time in our training, we weren't ready for it. So I always use a different term for it just because I have this lingering memory of Marshy saying that is, experience that it's a light body traveling with, and it just may be just semantics. It may be exactly the same thing. I can't really say, but I would call it a soul gathering aspects of myself, including my unified chakras. You know, there are seven chakras. That's a whole tradition of the spiritual path as well. I unify those chakras, put them in one place, and with what amounts to an ectoplasm. It's something that it's like a spider creating its a web. It's self-manifest, self-made. As I come up through the crown of my head and move higher into this temple of light, I'm moving within a bubble, within a sphere, if you will. And as time went by, and even maybe in preparation and a little bit for our show here, and I thought, okay, if I'm going to talk about this, it would be good if I had maybe some references. And actually in the Judeo-Christian Judaic tradition and in the Egyptian tradition, there's something called a Merkabah. And I didn't ever use that term when I was started doing this practice, and Keshava didn't call it a Merkabah, Murqaba. But in the Judaic tradition, it's called the Star of David. And it amounts to a chariot. The translation of Merkava is chariot or vehicle of light. And like the spider who creates its own web, we have this ability to, because consciousness has this great range of flexibility, we can create through our intention, that's the key, intentionality, a bubble, an ectoplasmic bubble, if you will. And we just travel in that powered by thought and intention. And so you are absolutely still connected to your body through your silver cord. The silver cord, I'm sure, has been talked about in these people books that have had these near-death experiences, because had the silver cord severed, they would have passed. They would not be alive. As long as the silver cord is intact between the physical body and the soul aspects that are moving wherever they're moving, they may just go from here to Chicago, they may go off planet, whatever, you are, quote, alive. But if it were to be severed, that would be it. So anyone who's ever written a bestseller about a near-death experience has not had the silver cord severed.
You know, I've heard various things about the silver cord, and different people interpret it different ways in terms of all that, which is just another aspect of this that we could get into, is that not everyone agrees on these particulars. But I don't want to go there.
No,
because
we don't.
To me, that's the... No, I want to stay right where you're at.
Okay.
But to me, that's the level two stuff. You know, is it real? Well, yes, I can prove it in this way and that way. I take what you're saying as true. And then I say, now, Steve, you're the expert I want to talk to about this. And I want to just kind of dive right into my thing here.
Because,
okay. So now I'm looking at the ET stuff, right?
Okay.
And one of the things I'm looking at is that we've tried this sensory deprivation thing, it looks like. We've done it in a very horrible way, but just Whitley Strieber is the great example on this. Whitley Strieber, and I played the clip, I'll probably inject it into this show as well. Here's his interview on the Higher Side Chats recently. Excellent interview that Greg did with him there, but he said this other places in his books. He remembers being a seven-year-old kid in San Antonio, Texas, and being enlisted, brought into this program with these other children where they were doing exactly the kind of stuff that you're talking about. And their intent was to break these people into this extended realm. This is a Stranger Things kind of thing, if you're familiar with the Netflix series that was huge. Well, the parallels with the Tibetan Lama story that you're telling is just chilling. But there's something that we have to really put our finger on here and try and get to the bottom of is the morality of this and the mechanics of it. To a certain extent, these people are saying, this is no big deal. This is a mechanical, scientific, materialistic process that we can manage, control. If you're a shadow government kind of guy, we can weaponize, you know, but that seems to be their intent.
Yes.
So now we have to pull back and say, okay, to what extent are these extended consciousness realms flexible and not in the way that we were talking about before? That's question one that I think we've answered. They are flexible and you can enter them in different ways. Now, where the hell is spirituality in this? Where is God in this?
Hopefully, my purpose has been served in having these out-of-body experiences, because I have chosen to direct where I go to places where I have received more advanced training, a chance to be closer to divinity. And one of the groups that I have been, like say, fortunate enough, or I've interacted with and learned from, are a group from the Syrians, not the Syrians in the Middle East, but the Syrians on Sirius B, the brightest, I believe it's the brightest star in the night sky. And these, I want to step back and say, I've never, ever been abducted. I've never been on a UFO. These are not things where I've taken my physical body to have that experience, but they're very real for me from the point of view of using my light body for travel in a spiritual manner. So if we are comfortable with the premise that the flexibility of reality and the flexibility of consciousness is limitless, then we have that ability to move interdimensionally. I have experienced time travel into the past, which I felt less safe with than spatial travel. Don't know if I need to elaborate on why, but if you mess up in the timeline, you might not be happy with where you end up. But in the kind of travel I've done where I interacted with the Syrians, I was very comfortable. So we could talk about their physical description, what they taught me. What would you rather have me focus on here?
Jump right into it. I think, you know, this is really, really challenging stuff. I like the way you said, you know, let's step back and kind of go through our knowns at this point, if we're willing to go there. You know, our knowns is that there is this flexibility to reality, and you can hit the tennis ball, and Michael Jordan can see the hoop is as big as the moon, you know, so that's real. And that's, and then we take, you know, the again, starting with parapsychology, and we say, what's presentiment say? It says time isn't really what we think it is. And then I got my buddy, you know, Dr. Andy Paquette, who's been on the show, 5,000 precognitive dreams that he's cataloged and published peer-reviewed papers on. Precognition, folks, blows our idea of time. So that's on the table. And then this astral travel, traveling outside of your body, people being able to see and report things back and they're true. That's all on the table.
Yeah. Alex, the Tibetan lamas don't think twice about traveling, not just the ones that sit in their cubicle for 3 years. They say, listen, we all do it sleep. We don't wake up knowing we've done it. Some do. Some people say, wait, I visited so-and-so. I went to this place or that and have some sense that it was real. But other people say it's just too fuzzy and I can't go there and I don't believe that that's possible. And in a sense, when they say, I don't believe that's possible, they've just shut the door on it. So that's another thing about infinite flexibility of consciousness, you are the free will decider. And if you say, I have the potential to have this experience, then you do have that potential. So
with that, we've laid the foundation where I feel comfortable we can start talking about Sirians from another planet that you've astral traveled to, and you're willing to say, hey, I think you know that that's real, but...
The shadow government has tried to present, I don't know what terms people understand it as, the cabal, the evil guys, the people with the negative agendas. They've tried to feed us the concept that life outside planet Earth, either one, doesn't exist at all, or if it does, it's evil, and it's going to hurt us or harm us or annihilate us or create catastrophic condition. I couldn't say anything that is further from the truth. The extraterrestrial souls that I met were, if you were want to use an analogy, go to a playground, go to that playground in Del Mar there, right on the grassy area, and just on a Saturday, and watch 10 or 12 children between ages of 6 and 10 having fun. That was my experience with these beings. They were so unbelievably kind and loving and innocent, a little almost frail, but very doe-like in their eyes, large, peaceful, innocent eyes, but like children. That's the physical side and the personality, but in terms of the consciousness side, I had the impression that they could incinerate me in the blink of an eye. They would never do that, but they had the power to do anything because they had the positive intent behind it. They had the power of the Creator in their consciousness because they had the purity to not misuse it. So my interactions were on multiple occasions, and they taught me a lot of things about myself and about interesting comments about our planet, which I had to think about quite a bit before I could really digest. I said to them, okay, it seems to me that a lot of extraterrestrial beings from different civilizations have an interest in Earth. And they said, that is true. The majority of those organizations, those individuals in those societies, civilizations, have a very positive interest in the planet. There are some who have a negative agenda and would like to continue what they're doing, controlling the scenario, situation here. But they said to me that what the Earth is moving towards soon, but they wouldn't put a time on it. They said it is a radical and major transformation for our planet. And that right now is the biggest game in the universe. It has the attention of many, many civilizations in our galaxy and beyond, because on Earth, and this is the mind blower to me, they said, on Earth, you have been blessed with the presence of divinity in a human form from time to time. Whether it was Buddha or whether it was Krishna or whether it was Ram or whether it was Jesus or whoever, he said, you have had, God has taken individual personalized body on Earth at various times, and that hasn't happened in other parts of the universe. And I said, well, wait a minute.
That's always really troubling for me. It's the center of the universe thing.
Center of the universe, no, I agree with you. I don't think that we would be fair to say that we are too egocentric to make such a comment. But I took the skeptical point of view on this. I said, well, wait a minute. If I'm not correct, you are light years beyond my state of consciousness. And they smiled, and I think they didn't deny that. They may be millions of years past. So I said, okay, how is it that our lowly, ignorant planet has had divinity walking on it, and you're so far ahead of me, so far ahead of any human being that I could tell, that they had all the supernormal powers. They demonstrated some for me. They, the ability to shape shift, the ability to do all the things we. They told me they don't even use verbal language very often. It's the universal language of telepathy, and they said that some of your religious traditions believe that your planet is only 6,000 years old. Biblical scholars will, if they're purists, they'll say that. And they said, they laugh and they said, you have had at previous epochs, you have had human life as you're seeing it, as we live it, with the powers and the abilities that we have. You just don't have it in your records. It's either been erased or forgotten, but your planet is billions of years old. And if you look at the Vedic references, Sat Yuga and different yugas in the Hindu Vedic tradition, you will find that, and you'll find references to the fact that human beings live for tens of thousands of years in Sat Yuga. Now, all that's going to be quite a handful for people to digest, but those are a few of the comments they made. And they said, we have 17 planets here. One of them is called Archives, and we'll take you to Planet Archive. And the Archive was basically this huge library of crystals, and the crystals were the keepers of all this information. So we have basically, the Syrians said, we have basically all the information in the Milky Way galaxy here with us, not the universe, but within our galaxy. And we have all of your Vedic records. We have all of your scriptural records. You on Earth don't even have that, because there have been agendas which have taken it away, have destroyed it. So, but we're preserving it for the time and place when you are ready for it. So they were blowing me away with that. We went to that that planet archive. We went to hospital. These are the kind of English translations for their 17 planets, which are gravitationally placed around a sun. And a hospital is primarily spiritual healing. And I could tell you the experience I had there. I had this lifelong pain in my neck, and which they clarified for me was the result of dying as a gladiator sometime back in Roman times with the bite of a lion on the neck. And they said, here's how we're going to heal that. We're going to show you how to reference a past incarnation of yourself where your neck was perfectly fine. And you're not going to take everything from that past life, but you're going to take the information, the DNA, the knowledge of a perfectly healthy neck from that previous life, and you're going to just bring it with your consciousness into your current situation, and that itself over time will heal it. It worked. Now, I don't know if I had their help to do it. It worked. My neck has been perfectly normal, but I was in a lot of pain back in the day, 30 years ago. So those are what the kinds of things they were doing on the planet called Hospital. And by the way, the planet Hospital is open to anyone in our interstellar family that wants to come and have that kind of care. So these things are stretching the imagination, I can imagine.
They are. Put on your skeptical cap here, because you are very much of a down-to-earth guy in a lot of ways that we talked about, and that's why we kind of approach this. If you're a tennis coach, you're an MBA, and you work with some very high-level Indian business people and gain their respect because you have all your faculties and you're very good at playing the consensus reality game. So put on your skeptical cap, and what troubles you most about that story? What troubles you most about believing that?
The whole Syrian experience?
Yes.
The disbelief that they were looking to us in any way. Because I said, well, what's your mantra? Do you have mantra? He said, no, we've just borrowed, if you don't mind, we're just going to slip into your mind and we're going to just use your mantra. Is that okay? I said, you're welcome. I said, if you're perfect, but why don't you have a mantra? He said, we haven't had that knowledge. I said, how could you have risen to the state of your exalted? Because they honestly were an extremely highly evolved state of life and bliss. I mean, just mind-boggling. How could you not have had a mantra? So, well, that was not part of our, we didn't have that training. That they went back to this thing, that's the Earth's Dharma. That is part of what's going on Earth. And she said, by the way, that's going to be exported from Earth all through the galaxy over time. And that's where my boundary hit, and I said, how does it work that way, that you can be so far advanced from our civilization and be looking to us for anything? We should be looking to you. And they just smiled very innocently, like maybe a child, and said, that's going to be a big, big thing when planet Earth matures enough to share what they're blessed with. Apparently every part of the universe has its own blessing, and that's our unique niche. And But I've struggled with that, and I've thought a lot about it, and I don't know that I've come to a conclusion, because I just interacting with those beings was such a mind blower that it seems shocking that they would look to me or anyone to you for anything, because they seem so. I'll give you another example. They have a out of the 17 planets, they have a planet called Creation. We don't mean creating the universe kind of creation, but whatever they need in their culture, they manifest from the life stream, from primordial matter, what they need. And they said, one day, you mark my words, one day when your bad people are removed from power on Earth, we will give as gifts to you cubes. And these cubes will go into every home, and these cubes will create whatever ideal temperature you want without any cost whatsoever. But until the money mongers are removed, they would immediately co-opt it and try to, you know, make a big profit out of it. But we will, that's something that they manifest, know how to manifest. They have replicators. They don't, they do have a planet for farming, but they can make instantly out of the field of the consciousness what they want for sustenance. And usually they eat fruit nuts.
That's where it starts to break down for me.
Okay.
Is a couple ways. One is, we just said time is flexible, and yet, or in reality is flexible in all these ways, and they're confirming that, and yet they seem bound to certain very materialistic sounding things. You know, well, we have to go to this planet for this. We have to store this in a crystal. I mean, it sounds so dorky for someone who's traveled outside of their body to another planet. Why do we have to do that? Why do we have to concern ourselves with time? Why do we have to worry about the good people and the bad people? Where is God in all this? I mean, are we just in another? So one is resolving those realities. So let's just start there. I won't go on.
Well, you play, you know, some of it might be a concession to just kind of play the stupid game, because we got this humanoid, this guy, me, and they were trying to share this in a way that he can relate to. I'm only speculating that, okay, I do know that they don't, that's kind of a little more cosmic in nature, that when we talked about their form of government, he says, we have no government, we have a consensus. When we need to make a decision, we just have everyone put their individual consciousness into the collective pool, and out of that unity of our awarenesses, we automatically come up with what's right for our group of beings. And so that was another planet, government. But again, whether they're playing the game because they're part of creation and they want to have these kind of physical constructs, I never asked them those questions. You should have been there. You could have asked them much better questions than I'm doing.
No, not at all. I mean, I'm just... like, one of the things that challenges me with back to the near-death experience, if I can ground it there,
sure,
is the nice thing about the near-death experience is that these people are dead. Some people argue that and say, well, they're not really dead. It's like...
they're flatlined, yeah.
Yeah, they no longer have a functioning brain that we have under any understanding from our physical, biological way, how that could generate, sustain consciousness / memories, whatever you want to call it. And people who aren't there yet are not still listening to this interview, but we all know that data is there. But once we step beyond that, then we get these stories, Steve, that are all over the place. We have people who are encountering Jesus, people who are encountering light beings.
Gotcha.
So it does seem that the flexibility of this extended realm makes it hard to pin all this stuff down. The part that really challenges me are two things. One is, we are doing some of this evil shit. There's just no question about it. MK Ultra and what Whitley Strieber is talking about, they are actively yeah, trying to access these realms. And that adds a level of reality to it. That,
yes,
anyone who isn't, you know, thinking they can just dismiss this, look out, because they're trying to weaponize this in a way. And,
yes,
and I'd like to understand what the implications of that are. And that always leads me back to the same thing of, counterfeited spirituality? Is there a real spirituality? Does God kind of play at a different level than all this shit? You know, and when you are sat there to judge your life, be it in an alien ET incarnation or a human incarnation, you will, as this is what I take away from the near-death experience, you will be judged for everything that you've done. But you, your soul, will be the judge, and it will be among a bunch of loving, completely supportive other souls, and you'll probably judge yourself a lot harsher than they would, but everything will be judged. And in that sense, it kind of puts a different spin on this, but there just seemed to be a lot of stuff in the middle that is playing a completely different game, and it's confusing the heck out of me and a lot of other people is this middle game.
Yeah. Well, one finishing comment on this need for, you know, a replicator or a cube. Why I asked, why do you bother to use a craft? You can travel anywhere and bleed into any dimension you want. You could stand here in front of me in my house. I'm talking about the Syrians, and I'm sure other civilizations have that capacity. Why are you running around in motherships and scout crafts and so on? And, you know, for better, lack of a better answer, just, you know, it's fun. It's like it didn't seem to me that there was any great, profound, earth-shattering reason other than, you know, we're just doing it. It's like, why do the kids go to the playground? You know, you could just, you know, sit with your app and play with virtual reality and never even bother to go to the playground. So that may be one perspective, and I don't know if that's a satisfactory one, but that seemed to me that, you know, they showed us how they skied. They showed us how, you know, they have a, my last comment, and then I'll get back to what you're going to here, Alex, but they have a area called entertainment, a planetary area called entertainment. And I thought this was profound for me. They said, two of the things that we value the most are pleasure and relaxation. We consider them very important for our spiritual well-being. And on that particular area, in that particular, it's open to you, it's open to me, it's open. Almost these areas are, although not at all in the timeline planet, is not open, because, again, if you start getting into timeline manipulation, master timeline stuff, you could really mess up some reality. So that you have to go with someone who's got certification. So they told me. So anyway, that's enough of rambling on the Syrians. You brought up two or three ideas there. Which one, if you wanted to kind of hone in on one particular area of your thoughts, go ahead.
The part that makes sense to me that I can't kind of resolve with the other stuff is, like I told you from the NDE thing, we're all going to be judged. Karma, judgment day, Christian, you know, it crosses all, and it makes total sense, yet it's been co-opted by all our religions, right? So what I love about the judgment thing is you tell that to a Christian and they're just nodding their head right there, and you say, okay, but here's the thing. Jesus ain't judging you. God ain't judging you. You're judging yourself. And they go, what? How would that work? And then when you really think through it from a spiritual standpoint, you go, well, that's the only way it could work. That's the only way that it would make sense. That, in a way, puts all this other stuff as in the middle, if you will. It's just in the middle. It's a transitory kind of thing between. Do you get where I'm going?
I think so. I think so. Yeah. Yeah, in a sense, the stuff in the middle, it's very illusionary, but it also is real. We are working. We could think this is cliched, but we're just in a school. This life is a school, and it happens very quickly. And if Vedic references say that we live much, much longer, which actually would be a benefit to the schoolhouse, because a lot of times we'll perform an action which we will evaluate ourselves at some point in time at the end of our life, in between life, whatever. But because our lives are so bloody short, 70, 80 years, a lot of the back-end learning that we could have, say we mistreated this person badly, we don't maybe live long enough to see the because the universe, the actions in the universe are circular. it circles back in mandalas. It comes right back to us, but maybe we pass before that lesson comes back to us and we, you know, receive the same treatment from somebody else or have the same illness or something like that. We haven't learned our lesson. So we got to come back and do it again. And that's one of the things that they say is so valuable about of having an extended life or extended perspective is that we learn these things much better than having to sit and watch it on a TV screen in some heavenly port with some guide sitting next to you saying, hey, you kind of messed up there, Steve, but that's for you to judge. You know, we could actually work it out. And if we could even tie that back to the whole the guru phenomena of why are they not infallible? Why are they not God-like if they're teaching us how to find God? And I've heard gurus say that, you know, the scriptures will say who's more important for a person, the guru or God? And the phrase is the guru is because without the guru, you can't find God. So you get these kinds of trainings and teachings, and then you find that your guru or some guru is making mistakes, and you start to go, why is that? Have they not resolved their karma? Have they not resolved their issues? Have they not looked into their experience? And to a certain extent, they have, maybe more than we have, but they also live with something called lesha vidya, the faint remains in the Vedic parlance. That's a Sanskrit phrase. It's lesha vidya, the faint remains of ignorance that we come into in this life, bringing a suitcase of karma, parabdha karma. And if we gain our nirvana, if we gain enlightenment, then we still are going to live out our life. And many, many great saints have died of cancer, had throat cancer, I know one particular, or had terribly debilitating experience. So it's still part of a package of karma that even though they may have been enlightened, they were still working out because the arrow had been shot, the karmic arrow had been shot, and they were receiving it at some point in time. So all these things come into play. It would be nice if we were able to resolve our issues neatly, you know, but it doesn't seem to happen that way a lot of times. And we get hit with this horrible financial karma in the middle of my life, and I say to myself, what the heck did I do to deserve that? Or my wife says, sayonara, I'm out of here. I can't even stand the sight of you anymore. What did I do to deserve that? And so we start to get cynical or depressed or, you know, sick or this or that, or why did my boss do that to me? And if we take ownership and say there's not a single thing that can possibly happen in our life that has not been initiated by our own consciousness, then we're if we can say that, and if we can buy, if we can live that reality, then we're really, that's a big step forward in the processing of our steps of evolution. Again, I don't know if we still need to dig a little bit. What else do we need to?
I think we're getting there. You know, we could go on and on, really, because you have so many, many stories and experiences and a broad range of them. And this is something you think about and obviously work on regularly. But let's wrap it up. We've been at it for an hour and a half, and you have some tennis duties to go off and do.
Let me mention, Alex, anybody who's watching is wondering, why the heck is Steve standing? I just want to confess, I hurt my back a few days ago on the tennis court, and I can do anything but sit right now. Even driving my car is a little, I can even teach tennis, but sitting, for some reason, it's right the pinch of the lower back. So I've been standing here for the whole, and that's the reason.
Okay, full disclosure. No, it's been awesome. Our guest again has been Steve Briggs. One of the books you want to check out is India, Mirror of Truth. What's the best way for people to read that book and find it?
I have a website at stevebriggsauthor.com, and I sell it there. It's sold on all the online, you know, Amazon and Barnes and Noble. Both my books are sold in those places. Both books are sold on my website, stevebriggsauthor.com. And so I'd be delighted if you want to buy it through my website. Of course, I'd be happy to, that way it would give me a chance I could sign it for a person if they wanted the book signed. And I do give, you know, some discount when I sell it through my website because we don't have the stores taking their percentage. So.
Well, I do encourage people to check it out. And in particular, you know, the way I was trying to go with this interview, and I think we accomplished it and then some in terms of going and talking about your astral body travel to the Sirian planet and visiting ETs and talking about, which blows people away. But what I want people to know is both in this book that I've read and the other one that I haven't, but I just in what you've told me these are accounts that are verifiable. I mean, you were there in India. Here is the photo of the sadhu that you were sitting next to. Yeah. So if people are kind of taken aback and can't swallow all of that stuff, read the book. Read the book, because it's very down to earth, and yet the book is also a launching pad for some extraordinary experiences that are in the book as well. So we have to find a way to incorporate in your reality, or we're just burying our head in the sand and we just can't do that. What are your comments on that, Steve?
Well, I have been patiently hoping that greater group of humanity would take note of what's going on all around us, both the positive and the negative. But I do feel that people are just a little bit too passive, and I'll turn on CNN News and go, oh, this happened. And I'll tell you, from my experience and in the inner fields of consciousness and in my guides and so forth, they said, listen, that's the last place you should rely. Don't rely on, quote, network news, all these things. You just need to disconnect from that, because it has an agenda, which is not to develop your consciousness, but to restrain it somehow. So I do feel that on the positive side, that people are waking up. You know, that's Rick's show, Rick Archer's show, people waking up and their individual experiences. And I thought I'd woken up quite a bit, and just 3 months ago, I had this beautiful, we call it darshan, internal darshan experience, and happened to be with Maharshi, and he showed up in a moment of lucidity when I was meditating in the night, and he put both hands on my forehead, and I'll tell you, I thought the rheostat was pretty bright inside, but it just went up about a few notches, and I was, again, blown away by what the potential is for what a guru might do or a mentor might do of what I have always felt was an impressive stature that Maharshi had. So that happened just in June. And I just, you know, say, okay, I see the shortcomings in my mentors, but I also see the blessings that they've shared with me. So I just, that would be a final comment too, that don't expect perfection in, you know, use discrimination, you know, evaluate who you're going to take knowledge from. And if your feeling level, your heart feels right about it, if your intellect makes sense to you, then we want to move along. We want to take that up, but don't go in blindly. You know, talk to your friends, talk to the people you trust, and go in with your eyes open.
You know, the other thing, I guess, in the couple minutes we'd have that I'd like to talk about is, I feel like it's important to choose good and to choose the right path, because I think that it's easy when we look at all the information we get about these extended realms, you know, in the same way we're talking about the evil that is being done, you know, evil is very present, and it is very tempting. And I don't know, it sounds very Christian. I don't mean it in a Christian sense, but we have to choose good. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, Keshava said to me, very frankly, said there are some very bad people in Washington, London, Beijing, New York City. He said they have very bad intention, and you have to be aware that they are not serving the best interests of humanity. So if we're naive enough to just buy into everything that Washington puts out there or our financial people in New York, then we may be setting ourselves up for a big shock. But beyond that, I would say, and this is a lesson I really have still continued to work on, and that is the thing that what Keisha said is that, Steve, every thought, when the thought you have is propelled by a strong emotion or feeling behind it, that takes on a life of its own, that thought itself. It becomes like a living being, and it moves. And as it moves out of you to wherever you're sending it, I don't like that person cheated me in the tennis match, it gathers more energy of like quality. And then, surprise, it circles back. Now you have to, as you begin to decide how you're going to feel about your ex-wife or how you're going to feel about your boss or how anything, keep that as a reference point. And I continue to consciously go, wait a second, you know, I don't really want to, you know, send an arrow somewhere that I know will ultimately come back and hit me right in the chest. So that is a lesson that I'm still working on, among others, but that's one that I really think we could all benefit from. And that's a lesson that I really was impressed by the Tibetans. They, I won't say they're not feeling people at all, because they're beautiful. And I loved all my interactions, but they are not interested in leaping into the game kind of the way Westerners might do it, and just, you know, putting on the gloves and slugging it out. They have a little bit, you know, like, okay, well, that, well, I see that you've been done wrong to, but maybe say, well, there's karma involved, there's all these other things involved, so don't just leap in and start swinging, because it's going to come back. So that's a personal lesson that I continue to almost read stuff every day to remind myself that's something that I feel I'm still, you know, in school for.
Yeah, buddy, I'm in school for that one too.
Well, we wouldn't be here if we, you know, if we didn't have a few lessons to learn, and it's part of the deal. And I'm good with that. And we will evaluate, you know, we'll grade ourselves at the end of the term, at the end of the class, before we move on to the next grade. We'll have that chance to grade ourselves, to judge ourselves, see how we did, and see what we didn't do so well, and we will correct it. And time, which has no reality ultimately in this big, infinitely flexible soup, we have all the time we need. You know, whether it happens, we want it. As Americans are really cool from point of view, they want to, if they could do something, they want to do it today. They're not going to say, let's wait and we'll do it 20 years from now. Over in Asia, I see that philosophy of, oh, that, we'll get to that eventually. And there's a little bit more passivity. But that's a great thing, because you won't get your enlightenment unless you start doing something today and tomorrow and the next day. That's a great quality of Americans. The other side of it is, you know, patience is also a requirement. Patience and tolerance. I think that we could all benefit from more patience, more tolerance toward ourselves as well as others. Yeah.
Awesome, Steve. Okay, so folks, do check out Steve's books. We'll have a link in the show notes to his website. Steve, let's stay connected. I'd love to have further conversations with you about this. Thanks so much for being here.
All right. Well, great talking. I enjoyed it very much.
Thanks again to Steve Briggs for joining me today on Skeptico. I think it's going to be hard to sidestep the information that emerges in this interview about the Syrians and the specific information about their other planets, and they have all the information in the world stored in these crystals. And I don't know quite what to make of that. It's certainly hard for me to swallow that as a literal reality, but I think Steve is also open to the possibility that he doesn't know how much of that was even intended to be taken literally, or how much of that experience was something that's supposed to fit back inside of our day-to-day normal reality. But what I'd like to challenge you to think about and engage with me about is the process of going from the known to the unknown. Because as we've explored on this show, there's plenty of people we encounter who are really stuck on the scientific, materialistic, biological robot reality and cannot go any further. Most of us listening to this show have said, well, that doesn't make sense either, just based on the most solid scientific data we have. But of course, the problem, and we've all encountered this, and I think we're all wrestling with it, is what do we do when we take the next step that takes us further and further down that rabbit hole? What do we do when we look at the work of Dean Radin and we say, oh, presentiment seems to be real, so I guess my relationship with time is not what I think it is. Oh, consciousness extends beyond bodily death, and my consciousness can leave this body and then seems to be able to leave this earth. Well, what does that mean in terms of consciousness traveling, and how far can it travel, and what can it know and bring back from those travels? These are all steps that I think most of us have taken along this journey. But the challenge is, what do we do when we encounter Steve Briggs and he adds another layer on top of that that says, I encountered these yogis in India and they do this and this and this, and they can demonstrate it over and over again. And then what do we do when he says, oh, and by the way, I took what they taught me and I travel to the Sirius Star and talk to these people, as you heard in the interview. What do we do with that? What do you do with that? How do you process that? That's the question. It's a big one, but I'd love to hear your answer. The place to do it, of course, is through the Skeptiko website at S-K-E-P-T-I-K-O, where you can find all the previous episodes of Skeptiko there for free to download and use as you please. Do stay with me. I got some good stuff coming up. But until next time, do take care and bye for now.